10 is essentially boilerplate, which 100% conflicts with the other two paragraphs. Paragraph 4 states that the tenant will be responsible for all repairs and maintenance to the property, including the roof. Paragraph 12b also provides a litany of responsibilities that the tenant would be obligated to cover, including repairs to the roof and roof skins. Paragraph 10 is quite dissimilar in that it says that upon notice, the landlord would be responsible for that maintenance. Obviously, in this case, there was a leaking problem. There was issues with water intrusion into the property. And there was an issue of who was responsible for its repair.
May I ask you this? Is it the landlord's position that the lease is ambiguous, or is the lease unambiguous?
Your Honor, the lease as a document is ambiguous in that it conflicts.
Was that the position the landlord took in the trial court?
Yes. The landlord took the position that the ambiguity was actually a conflict, and that the paragraph 4 and paragraph 12b should be imposed. And the tenant obviously took the position that because paragraph 10 was there, that he could rely on that. There really was not much evidence given as to how those paragraphs were negotiated or were inserted, but the court did address that issue. We brought it up to the court, and the court said, well, it's obviously an ambiguity. How do I resolve that? We suggested how he should resolve it. He went ahead and heard evidence. His ruling was a little bit Spartan. We don't know exactly how he resolved that conflict. Obviously, he resolved in some way against us. That's our assumption.
Was the document drafted by the landlord?
In a sense, Your Honor, the document was prepared on the landlord's agent's computer. If that's drafting, yes. The document was prepared by them, but there was also negotiation of specific provisions. Specifically, when the tenant took over, he was granted, I believe, $12,200 for rent abatement, for repairs of the roof.
Well, when those provisions were added, were the provisions crafted by the landlord side of the negotiation or the tenant side of the negotiation?
Now, there's really no evidence as to who crafted the language specifically. What there is, in fact, Bishop Gales was asked whether he had negotiated with the landlord. And first he said, well, no. Then he went on to describe the negotiations he had with the landlord. So he had discussions with them, with the real estate agent. With the real estate agent in this case was one of the owner's children, but discussed it with them, and it was inserted in the document that they would get $12,000.
You know where I'm heading is the bishop, and the bishop's people didn't do the craftsmanship. Is it that I'm heading?
You know, I believe that's fairly clear, although it's not specifically addressed.
So why wouldn't the doctrine of contra preferendum, you construe against ambiguities against the drafter, particularly when the ambiguities are so obvious here, why wouldn't that be a reasonable position for the trial court to take?
You know, we're not sure that that's the position the trial court took, but if it did, and that's certainly the position that the tenant would have urged, I think that is a doctrine that this court has started to get away from if there are other provisions or other rules of construction which would resolve the question. We did cite a case from 2014, Your Honor, Robinson Huntley v. Georgia Washington Carver Medical Homes Association, in which the court said, we have often applied the rule that Robinson Huntley advocates, that the rule of reading against the drafter. And while the rule can assist courts in resolving ambiguities where there's no extrinsic evidence of the party's intent or where such evidence is in equipoise, this is not such a case, and we will not apply that rule here. So, basically, the rule against the drafters, the default position, you can't side any by any.
When, and don't all those canons, whether it's statutory construction, where you're trying to determine legislative intent, or contractual canons, where you're trying to determine the intent of the parties, they all drive at the same point, which is you're trying to figure out what the parties meant.
And I agree with Polestar, what is the intent of the parties? And so what we've urged in this part of our appeal is that if you look at the other rules of construction, the UCC with typing over form and handwriting over typing, and the rule and wills where the scrivener takes precedent over the form, all of that is really to get to the specific intent or the special attention of the litigants or the parties. So if we're looking at a will, we know that if the person hand wrote it in, that's the latest version of his intent and probably what he means. In the UCC, we know if we've got a form and they've stricken it out and typed over, it's probably what they mean. In the modern setting, if you've got a computer and you've got a form, you've stricken through a bunch of things and you've added in bold print and different font what you think the parties mean, then that should probably take precedence, so, because that's the special intention of the parties, the special attention as well. And that should take precedence over boilerplate. Now, in this position, in this particular case, the boilerplate is so obviously in conflict with the rest of the document. I think that the presumption should be that the parties intended what was in bold print.
Why is that? I mean, do you have any authority as to why bold print shows more intent than blue print?
No, it shows better notice. There's reports in this case that show that, you know, in we've cited several of them in our paperwork where a confess judgment document requires bold print in certain fonts so that it provides notice that people know what they're doing when they're signing this document.
That's statutory.
It is. It
That's
is.
Why?
There's also language in the cases in which people assign forms for gun applications where there's a warning that they can't acquire the gun application if they're felons, etc., and that's in bold print. I can't point to anything, any rule of construction from this court that says bold print is in a contract is of consequence.
Can you find, is there any authority you're aware of from any court that you give greater weight to bold print?
Specifically bold print? No. Your Honor,
doesn't that sort of lead us back to the contra-preferendum point that I asked you about a minute ago, which is, you know, when the bold print or the all caps or whatever are being added by one side, who's doing all the draftsmanship, the drafter, the thumb is on the scale against the drafter, because the drafter is causing the problem by putting all these provisions in there that's contradictory. Isn't it fair to say, look, if one side or the other is in charge of drafting and they screw it up and there's no real way to understand it, whatever the interpretation is going to lean against them. Why would that not be a reasonable answer to this kind of case?
But, you know, it could be, Your Honor. In some cases, it has been in the past. The truth is that in this case, we had lay people, no lawyer involved. The document there was no testimony. They were the plaintiff, and there was no testimony in the case as to they really meant paragraph 10, or they really didn't mean paragraph 4. So, as far as the burden of proof as to who intended what, I don't think it's carried by the plaintiff. They didn't even say, hey, we were relying on paragraph 10. So, that could be a resolution of it, but it's a resolution which is not based on intent. It's based on basically a fault base. It's based on a
presumed intent.
A division of loss between the parties. Mm-hmm. And in a case where you can pretty much tell what they intended, and the testimony in court was that the landlord really didn't want to be a landlord. They wanted to sell the property to the church. The church had an option to buy it. They were trying to transfer the property as much as possible to be ownership until the church was able to arrange financing. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense in that context. In the first paragraph, it said, you know, responsible for any and all repairs and maintenance. And then they even have them responsible for property that was common area with others. So the landlord really didn't want to be involved in ownership and maintenance at all. And all that language was put in there. So,
And what you had was they leased it for a while, and then they decided to have this set different arrangement, right? So they're taking an existing lease with its clauses already in place and modifying some of those, correct?
No, I believe the option to purchase, which was an addendum to the lease, was done essentially contemporaneously, so it was not done at the same time. So I can't say that was a modification, but the amendment was clear that the amendment to the lease was clear that that was the intent of the parties. There was testimony in trial from the landlord's representative that they wanted to sell it to them. The church testified they wanted to buy it. So that was their, you know, that was their intent. The other thing was that the church pastor was himself a contractor. So this was not unusual to say we're going to pass that responsibility to you. Well, Your Honor, if I could, the second issue we raised was that if we lose on that, if the court says and implies that the Virginia Beach Circuit Court must have said that we're reading against the drafter and we're applying paragraph 10. The problem with that for the church is that paragraph 10 also says that we're not responsible for any consequential damages. So the church's allegations, their suit, was for those repair maintenance costs they undertook in the beginning of the case. About $46,000 worth of costs that they inserted the church for various things. We're not sure exactly what portion of the repairs and maintenance that accounts for, but the bottom line is it was repairs and maintenance expenses that they put into the church back in 2009 and early 2010, and they say that they want that as a damage for being constructively evicted. You have to assume also the court found that constructive eviction was appropriate, but if the court finds that paragraph 10 applies, then shouldn't also the prohibition on consequential damages apply? And so the issue here then is this a consequential damage? Well, it's not a direct damage. A direct damage would be the damage to the roof and whatever gets wet underneath it. In this particular case, we're talking about the roof getting wet, the building getting damp, mold growing, people getting sick, ultimately them having to leave. That's a consequential damage, as clearly as it can. If you look back to, Abbey v. Baxendale, et cetera, and go through that long line of cases, which is argued, I guess, and will be for, hundreds of years by lawyers, but it seems to us that that damage is clearly a consequential damage, even if you apply Rule 10, paragraph 10, which applies against us, then consequential damages is what they awarded, and there's no reason for that. It's specifically prohibited in the contract.
So you don't think that fixing the roof that's damaged is a consequence of damage, right? You would accept that as direct or not?
I would accept that as direct.
So the roof's fixed. The roof falls down and damages a property around it, allegedly in breach of the duty under paragraph 10. Would that be consequential or direct?
Your Honor, the repair of the roof or the damage to the roof would be direct. I would believe that the damage to the property beneath it would be direct as well.
Okay, so I follow you there, and I agree with that. So where is the line of consequential when you look at their exhibit that was in the trial transcript at 30 and 32, the $65,000 exhibit?
Your Honor, the list of damages there included the repairs that they made back in 2009 and 2010.
Right.
So that property was not damaged by the moisture.
I follow that, but could you take from the $65,000 exhibit, could a rational fact finder take from it in any composition of or combination of line items the verdict here as direct damages as a result of alleged breach of paragraph 10? In other words, can you cut and paste from that document and just come up with it on your own?
Actually, I couldn't, Your Honor. When I tried to come up with $46,000, there was a number of invoices that were in there from a contractor, I believe it was called Boliva Enterprises, and the number didn't add up to $46,000. It may have been other numbers. There's repairs to the interior, but the repairs to the interior are to a different part of the building. There are repairs to the roof itself. Now, some of those repairs to the roof, we actually reimbursed them about $5,000 for that, and that's shown in the case. So that was not covered by this. So from my, it's very difficult to see what they were claiming. I think it's fair that the court probably determined that, well, they put $46,000 in, and maybe they didn't get the benefit of that investment, so maybe in fairness we'll give that back to them. I think that's probably the thought process. But I can't tell you which $46,000 or why $46,000 was the number. Let's see if my time's up.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Clay Make, and on behalf of the appellee, the Church of the Good Shepherd, to start my discussion with the court, just a couple of things that Judge Kelsey brought to the attention of the court and to my friend, Mr. McCready. It appeared from the testimony, as I read the transcript, Bishop Gales is the only one that testified about the creation of a lease, and it was quite obvious. He stated that the lease was presented to him by the landlord, and he signed it. There was some earlier discussion between Bishop Gales and the owner regarding terms, but there was no back and forth. This was clearly the landlord's document. Also, Judge Kelsey, you mentioned about crafting the language. It appears in the lease, as you, if you look at the exhibit, the landlord clearly made some changes to the lease. There are strikeouts, and I'll briefly note this. Numerous portions of that lease are stricken on the computer where you can see the lines through. So it's hard to, it seems to us hard to imagine that the landlord can claim somehow that they're not responsible for the creation of this lease. The ambiguity is there. Judge Lewis, as I read the transcript, said from the very beginning of the case, there's an ambiguity here between paragraph 10 and paragraph 12B. How are we going to resolve that? And it seemed to me
it's not so much ambiguous as irreconcilable.
Exactly. It was irreconcilable, and so how are we going to resolve it? And I think Judge Lewis, I think the appellants say Judge Lewis didn't say why he came to his conclusions, but I think it's very clear. He used the maxim to use the creator of the document. It's held against the maker.
Why isn't the best inference from this that they took a standard form, struck out the stuff they didn't want, and added in bold the things that they had agreed to?
The only part I disagree on that is when you say they. I think the answer is the landlord.
Or landlord.
The
right.
Landlord put this...
So in other words, you had the non-bolded print as the stock form, and then so they pulled that up on the computer, strike out... But then, of course, once they sign it, that's what they agree to. So wouldn't the bold language be more probative of intent than the sort of the default backdrop language?
Right. Well, that's the argument that the landlord makes.
Right.
And what the landlord wants this court to do is raise the, quote, bold language into the same sphere that we have, you know, the common law of handwriting beats typewriting beats print. And I think that is not a good idea. I don't think this court should do that.
Well, not across the board, but if bold is essentially the equivalent of, just like when the legislature tweaks a statute, they'll strike through and you have the italics, and that shows you what was added. So if the bold, and I'm not asking you to concede that, but I'm trying to figure the case out, if the bold is what's most recent and added to a sort of backdrop form, then isn't that the equivalent of the handwriting on a will or whatnot?
And if it could be proven that there was back and forth and that this was the final result, I think the answer would be yes in this particular case. But I don't think we can get that far with the transcript that we have, because what it shows is, as I say, Bishop Gale says they gave me the lease and I signed it. And he didn't, it doesn't appear that he did any review of the lease. This was a church. They were very experienced landlords. And it was their document. So our view, of course, is go back to the standard. It's a document prepared by this party, the more sophisticated party. Let's hold, if there's a conflict, which there is, let's hold against
them. Are they necessarily the more sophisticated party?
Well, it is in that they...
He's a businessman and all that. I mean...
Well, I can't really make the court take that position, I suppose. If you look at the other cases, like the Nextel case that's cited, that one they held for the landlord, who, in my view, as I read the case, seemed the less sophisticated between Nextel, the big company putting up cell towers, and these couple of brothers that lived on top of a mountain. But when you read the case, it appears that the court does take into account that, you know, here is, if the testimony from that case, the Nextel case, was that these brothers dealt with six or seven people from Nextel and that they put in a specific provision. It seems that that is somehow taken into account. But I think the more important thing is, if there's a mistake, we have to hold it against the maker. And I think if we change this and we say, well, bold means something more, I think you open up a floodgate of things like, well, italicized versus regular. That should mean something.
I mean, we have to get there at some point because nobody's handwriting anymore.
Well, that's right.
Or at least it's greatly reduced compared to...
But what I would posit for the court is, don't make it easier to let people be lazy in the preparation of their documents. So if the court were to say, in this case, bold is wins, then I see in the future lousy contracts where somebody writes at the end the bold that they want. And
that's job security for us.
Well, that's accurate. On the issue of the ambiguity and the case cited by Mr. McCready.
May I interrupt you? I'm sorry. On the first question I asked the Landlord's Council, I was at the panel hearing that granted this writ, and I've gone back to the petition. The petition by the landlord told us, landlord suggested the trial court found ambiguity where none had existed. No ambiguity appears, semicolon. So I was understanding the case from that perspective that the argument was they were using rules of contractual construction to sort of pre-screen the ambiguity. But I'm hearing a different argument now. I'm seeing a different argument on the appellant's opening brief. Am I misreading what's happening
here?
Well,
the claim is that there was a latent ambiguity. But
it's a patent ambiguity.
Exactly. In fact, that's the opening of the appellee's brief. It is a patent ambiguity. It's right on the face. And there's no way we can square that ambiguity to make it make sense, because it doesn't make sense. And so the facts of this case are really outrageous. This church was had to leave the facility, and no one was making a repair. And I would also say,
if there's an ambiguity and we are looking to the testimony of the parties to help us understand what their intent is, if I understood the bishop's testimony, there was a problem with the roof, but they received a discount on their rent for the church, for the bishop to repair the roof.
If you read the transcript carefully, the way I read it, it said they had a $12,200 credit because there was apparently a big hole in the side of the building, and I had a hard time visualizing what that meant. And I believe in the cross-examination by Mr. McCready, there's discussion about that. I think Bishop Gales tried to make it clear that it was basically the big hole in the side of the building that they got the credit for. I don't think the roof was a major factor, at least from the testimony that I could read, and therefore what you have before you. I don't think it was a credit for the roof. I think it was just a general credit. In fact, in Bishop Gales' testimony, I believe he says something like, the landlord just came up with a figure and we accepted it. There was no discussion.
I'm looking at what I'm thinking is Bishop Gales' testimony on page 44 of the JA. The question, but your knowledge that the credit was given to make those repairs, correct? I'm not understanding. It wasn't the whole roof, it was just a part of the roof.
But I think before that, there's language about this big hole on the side of the roof.
There was language about the big hole, but the question says it wasn't the credit. It wasn't the whole roof, it was just a part of the roof. Now, I'll read it again.
I think there was an issue that was brought up where there was one portion of the roof that had something that was known, but I think the larger problem was not known at the time of the execution of the lease. I believe that's
but if the landlord provided credit for fixing the roof, doesn't that help your argument? You don't provide credit for fixing something you're not responsible for.
Well, that would be in the inception of the lease.
I think. But then later on, I thought that there was some evidence that
yes,
he provided additional.
Exactly. In fact, I was going to get to that point, that there is evidence that the landlord did provide, I think on two occasions, $2,500 to assist in some roof repairs. Also, I would point out, in the paragraph.
Had you finished with this question? I did have one other question.
Oh,
did Bishop Gales make the repairs?
No. I believe not. I believe he had contractors come in.
I know Maliva made some and Bailey made some subsequent. Bishop Gales didn't make the repairs.
I have to say, I don't know as a fact. It appeared from the billings that they were outsiders doing it, so I don't know that as a fact. On the same issue about this credit being given, and of course that would indicate some involvement of the landlord, also, even in the paragraph that the landlord wants you to take precedent, where it's the tenant's responsibility for the repairs, it says in that paragraph that the landlord may, if the tenant does not make the repair, the landlord can make the repair and bill the tenant. So, of course, why didn't they do that? If they were so sure that it was the tenant's responsibility, it would have made a lot more sense to fix the problem and let these people stay in the building and then have this argument at a later time as to who's responsible. Instead, the place deteriorated until they had to vacate. So on the issue of the case brought up, the Washington Co-op, about the ambiguity in the phrase. What I want to say about that, I believe, Judge Kelsey, you're the one that asked Mr. McCready about that. There was an ambiguity in a phrase in that case. The issue that was being presented was, why don't we go back to the, if there's an ambiguity in the contract, we hold against the maker. And the argument of the appellant is, well, if you can find another rule that fits, we should use that rule. And in the co-op, the Washington case that he's describing, there was not an ambiguity in the entire contract. There was ambiguity in one phrase. It was a between a co-op and a owner, where the phrase was provide and pay for repairs. And the question was, what did that mean? You know, how extensive were the repairs? And the court went on and found parallel evidence to try to determine what that phrase meant. That's different, we would argue, than the entire contract being ambiguous because of these competing provisions. You're not simply interpreting what a word means. This has polar opposites. Either the landlord's responsible or the tenant's responsible. On the issue of damages, just for clarity, we don't know exactly what Judge Lewis had in his mind, but it's pretty clear the amount of the judgment is exactly the amount on Exhibit 8 for one of the line items, which was replacing the fire escape and doing the windows. So it would appear to us that what Judge Lewis did was get rid of all the other repairs and come up with a figure that seemed as the most direct damages he could find. It seemed to him that by forcing, I'm surmising that he thought, by forcing the church out of the property, that they had made these improvements to the property, so they should be compensated.
Didn't the contract provide that you would be the tenant would be responsible for any repairs and improvements, and all improvements would be done at the tenant's sole expense?
One of those provisions says that, yes.
So, under the contract, why would you be entitled to the improvements?
Well, if there has been a breach by the landlord in not making the repairs, and they're forced out of the property, they've lost the benefit of their bargain. They've lost those items. I believe that's what the court had gave them back. And so that would be the issue on the damages. As far as the various items regarding the ambiguity, it sounds like the court sees it, as we see it, that this is an ambiguous case. I wanted to bring to the attention of the court the four items that were brought before you, the specificity versus the general argument made by the appellant as perhaps a way to get around the ambiguity. And, of course, we say it's not specific. There's no provision, at least, any more specific in paragraph 10 than it is in 12B, so you can't use that. The handwritten versus typed, the presumption of handwritten being favored by the typed. Our view, of course, is that that has nothing to do with bold print. They also made the argument that it was surplusage, that if you take out the word landlord in paragraph 10, this case works for the landlord. And, of course, our argument is we'll take out the word tenant in 12B. We'd rather you do that if you're going to use the surplusage argument. And finally, they make the argument for Scrivener's error. And I think the court, there might have been a little bit of a concession in the reply brief, but Scrivener's error, using the cases cited, there was no Scrivener to make the error. The case cited was the Williamsburg case. I can't think of the name of it, but it's cited in the brief, where the court said, if you don't have a Scrivener, there's no error. And any developer had inadvertently put too much land in a subdivision flat and wanted it to be reversed because he made a mistake, and the court said, that's too bad. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.